we want to hear your voice. We want to understand your issues.
Interior Department officials meet with North Slope residents. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Sullivan is not a fan of the president's proposed tariffs.
And, you know, I do worry about retaliation. I also worry about retaliation with regard to Alaska products.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
A high-profile guest was in attendance at the North Slope Borough Assembly meeting in Utqiagvik Tuesday. The Interior Department's second-in-command, Deputy Secretary David Bernhardt, addressed the mayor and the 11 assembly members at the Barrow High School auditorium.
And so we're here today to begin this conversation with you because we want to have you collaboratively and collectively involved with us as we go forward with our new job.
That new job is managing the oil and gas leasing program in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is within the North Slope Borough boundaries.
We want to hear your voice. We want to understand your issues. We have an opportunity to try and accommodate those issues that are of concern to you within our authority.
Assembly members had the chance to comment and ask questions. North Slope Borough Mayor Harry Brower Jr. thanked the deputy secretary for coming. He went on to say that oral communication is one thing, but he wants to start seeing plans in writing.
You know, I first thing I wrote down was, when do we start reading the information on in black and white, in written materials? That's something of importance.
Bernhardt responded that once the scoping process begins, more of those materials will become available. He also said he expects that process to kick off in the next few weeks. After the meeting, Bernhardt was also asked why three critical whaling areas were included in the initial draft of the president's plan for offshore leasing. Local stakeholders have identified those areas for exclusion in years past.
We started with what I would consider a zero baseline, where we started with, okay, let's presume that we were starting the dialogue fresh, and we'll see, the process will take the same amount of time either way, and we'll get comments and we'll decide whether it was right-sized nationwide or not yet. And so that's really where we're at.
The deputy secretary said he will also be visiting Fairbanks and Nome on this trip. President Trump is expected to announce new tariffs on imported steel and aluminum tomorrow. Senator Dan Sullivan wishes he would not. Sullivan says a trade war could slow the U.S. economy.
And, you know, I do worry about retaliation. I also worry about retaliation with regard to Alaska products, right? We're a huge exporter, particularly of fish and natural resource products.
Sullivan joins a growing list of Republicans in Congress who are speaking out against the president's proposal. The senator was in Houston Monday for an oil industry conference. He says industry executives worry the tax on imported steel will be bad for energy projects in Alaska, including the proposed pipeline to carry liquefied natural gas from the North Slope. Sullivan says the Alaska LNG project is also losing a well-placed champion with the resignation of Gary Cohn as Trump's chief economic advisor.
Gary Cohn's actually been one of the guys who's been very strongly focused on helping the AK LNG project in the White House. So from that perspective, it's not a positive development.
Trade groups for the oil and pipeline industries say their businesses require specialty steel that few U.S. steelmakers can produce. A natural gas trade association says the tariff could have the unintended consequence of stalling LNG export facilities, projects that would have improved the U.S. trade imbalance. The Alaska House Finance Committee has approved funding four additional lawyers to work in the Public Defender Agency. They approved the money at a meeting on Monday. Alaska Public Defender Quinlan Steiner says without more lawyers, his agency would turn down cases.
There's a principle of ethics that requires a lawyer not to accept a case if they can't competently handle that case, and not having enough time would be that reason. So we would attempt to refuse cases.
Steiner says if judges agree to those attempts, then it would cost the state more to hire private defense attorneys. Steiner says if judges say no, that would lead to substantial delays to resolve cases. Anchorage Independent Representative Jason Gren sponsored the amendment to provide $1 million to pay for the four lawyers and one support staff member. He notes that public defenders at the agency have too many cases, according to state and national standards.
One example is using the American Bar Association guideline for maximum ethical caseloads. It's about 150 cases per attorney per year. In FY 2018, Public Defender Agency is projected to have 160 cases per year per attorney.
The committee voted along caucus lines 7-4 to approve the amendment. Anchorage Republican Representative Lance Pruitt opposed the added money. He says the agency could better manage its budget.
I think the problem here is not a money issue, it's a management issue. How do you deal with the current situation that we're in? You deal with the current situation by adjusting how you deliver your services. I get it. It's difficult. We don't have the money right now.
Pruitt proposed firing higher paid lawyers and replacing them with lower cost, less experienced lawyers, but the committee rejected his proposal. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new documentary tells the story of the Indian woman who took on the federal government and won.
People in the audience tell me, thank you so much for telling this story, because I got a Cobell check and I didn't know who Cobell was.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
On Alaska's mayor has survived a recall effort that accused him of conduct and poor leadership. According to initial election results, 62% of voters supported Mayor Frank Kelty, who was waiting at City Hall when the polls closed last night.
I was concerned that it would be a pretty tight, maybe come down to the absentees, but it didn't, and I want to thank the community for their support.
Election officials counted the 463 ballots by hand after the voting machine jammed. Their tally showed 177 un-Alaskans voted yes to recalling Kelty, while 286 voted no. There are still 74 absentee and question ballots that must be canvassed on Friday, but the city clerk says they won't affect the final results. Kelty will remain in office for the rest of his term, which expires in October of 2019. He says he's glad the recall is finally over for both himself and the community.
I just hope the animosity and the anger goes away, and we can work together for the betterment of Unalaska.
Kelty says his first goal is to build a positive relationship with the new city manager. The Unalaskans who sponsored the recall petition weren't immediately available for comment. They had charged Kelty with pursuing an illegal dock agreement with the shipping company Matson, along with criticizing his leadership and respect for community process. A State Department of Environmental Conservation report issued Tuesday evening says an Army tanker truck that crashed Sunday near Harding Lake leaked 800 gallons of fuel within about 50 feet of a slough that leads into the Tanana River. The tanker's 2,600-gallon tank was carrying 1,500 gallons of JP-8 when the rig slid off the Richardson Highway near milepost 318 at about 2:30 p.m. Sunday. DEC spill program manager Tom DeRider says JP-8 is a kerosene-based fuel that the Army uses for both aircraft and vehicles.
That's a product that's very similar to diesel fuel. It's what the Army runs in all of their vehicles.
DeRider says Army contract Contractor personnel from Fort Wainwright were working to clean up the spill through Tuesday with help from DEC and Alaska State Troopers. The wrecked tanker was pulled back to Wainwright Monday afternoon. A U.S. Army Alaska spokesperson says the tanker was headed back to post from a field training exercise when the accident occurred. DEC report raises concern that the leaked fuel could contaminate the Tanana River. A situation report issued by DEC says fuel that leaked from the tanker has contaminated snow and soil. The report says that could flow into the slough and then the Tanana, possibly harming salmon in the river. Personnel with DEC and an Army contractor are working on a plan to remove contaminated snow and soil. An investigation into the crash continues. The Iditarod's image has suffered several blows over this past year. A dog doping scandal involving Dallas Seavey, stepped up protests from animal rights group PETA, and now an alleged dust-up between musher Wade Mars and the head toxicologist for the Iditarod, Maury Craig. Mars says Dr. Craig threatened him over his support for Seavey right before the race started on Sunday. Craig says he did not. Anchorage Daily News reporter Kyle Hopkins reported on this latest race drama and spoke with Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove about how it unfolded.
This was supposed to be a time of do the race, get the race over with, and then look at how to change that process or what was wrong with it. And instead, you have this revelation that, oh, here's a brand new, you know, scandal, if you will, that one of the top mushers and importantly, the head of the finishers club. So like the president of the union of mushers saying, hey, I had a really nasty conversation, kind of a spooky conversation with the head of this testing program from his point of view. And then the conversation we were having with the drug testing director was that he felt that his intentions and his words maybe were misinterpreted, and he denies that he was trying to threaten or intimidate the musher.
And then kind of what happened after that? It sounds like there was more information that came from Wade.
Right. So we had the initial conversation with the Iditarod drug testing director. Didn't publish a story. We were looking to get more information. I asked for information from Iditarod, asked for information from Wade's kennel. They didn't want to talk. They kind of wanted to wait and see what Iditarod did. I talked to the toxicology professor, the Iditarod drug guy again, and just got a better sense of the timeline. And at that point, he told me a couple times that this was an issue that Iditarod was looking into. He didn't feel like he did anything wrong, except he did want to apologize to Wade, and he did think that he probably should not have had that conversation at that time, because it's just a bad time to be kind of dropping a lot, you know, some highly charged information on the musher right before they're about to step on the runners and start their race. So at that point, I felt like we probably had a story that we could report, and we gave, you know, the Iditarod time to respond. They didn't really. And then eventually, when we finally pulled the trigger on the story, was when someone from Wade's kennel, his girlfriend, sent out this statement on his behalf that swung pretty hard at Iditarod, saying that they felt this was totally unprofessional. They felt like it was a threat. They felt like it was intentional intimidation.
So he finds out right before he's about to take off on the race, they put out this statement. Did they say more about, I guess, what the conversation was like? It sounds like the drug tester toxicologist was at least according to Stump Jumping Kennels, Wade's kennel, they were threatening him?
That's what Wade's kennel says, that they perceived it to be a threat. And the doctor, the toxicology professor, he says that all he did was answer Wade's question and talk about the facts of the drug testing.
And Maury Craig has some other skeletons in his closet. What are those?
In late October, he was fired from his job with Oregon State University. That he was fired because the university found that he had potentially committed sexual harassment and bullying of students. He says that's not true. He told me that's not true. He said it's related to his role as a landlord, that a student or multiple students rented and there was some kind of dispute. He's fighting it. He's trying to keep his job, but he actually apparently has been banned from campus at this moment. So he's still employed by the university, but he's really under a cloud back in Oregon.
Have you ever seen as much controversy around the race? It feels like that is sort of the story of this year's Iditarod.
Right. I think the story of this year's Iditarod is that the race is tearing itself apart from the inside a little bit in a way that I hadn't seen before. It's always under attack to some degree from outsiders. And the strength of that community often is, you know, they band together. They feel like if they can tell their story, if they can show people how they feel about the sport and about the dogs, that there's power kind of in the unity of the mushing community. Usually there's at least some unity in that they're all coming together in defense of their sport. And now you have, it just feels like there's a fissure in within the sport itself. You have Dallas skipping the race. You have people calling for, you know, to kind of cut off the head of the organization and replace it. And that stuff never came up before in the open. Maybe it was all happening behind closed doors before, but it never kind of spilled out into the street the way we've seen it this year.
Kyle Hopkins is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. The Iditarod race itself has hit its major lull as teams up and down the trail take their 24-hour rests. The pause allows dogs to recuperate from the hundreds of miles they've covered and lets mushers catch their breath, often allowing them to sleep for the first time since the Sunday restart. Generally, the most popular checkpoint to 24 is Tocotna, renowned for its hospitality, comfortable accommodations, and pies. It was just before 10 p.m. last night when Mitch Seavey arrived to a big welcome in the small town.
I'd like to stay.
Staying.
Okay. Yeah. Mitch, what's your bib number?
13. And I have 13 dogs.
Okay.
Seavey was in a good mood and unusually talkative as he declared his 24-hour rest. He frequently uses Tocotna for his 24 and parked his team in a preferred spot tucked just behind the community center. Seavey is well-positioned in this year's race, though it's still early, with mushers' long-term strategies starting to emerge. But Seavey has had to adjust his plans in order to contend with all the fresh snow, making for a slower trail. He scrapped his technique of carrying dogs in his sled, rotating them between runs and rest, a style of mushing he's helped refine in recent years.
It's too slow and soft this year. Well, it worked at first. I used it for a while. But I gave up on it because my dogs were working too hard. I hurt two dogs' back legs, I think, because of it.
Even though some of Seavey's runs between checkpoints were slower than in past years, the cumulative effect has been slight. He pulled into Tocotna at 9:45 p.m. In 2013, the last time Seavey won the race along the southern route, he arrived in Tocotna at 9:45 p.m., the exact same time. The reasons mushers like Tocotna so much are numerous, but most of them relate to how well set up it is for taking care of dogs and mushers alike. Teams are parked along a roomy hillside away from snow machine and foot traffic. The town's non-denominational church has a big sign that says no press on the front, helping to let mushers leave them relatively undisturbed as they nap. And Linwood Fiedler says it's just more comfortable than the other options up or down the trail.
Well, you certainly get better fed here. You don't have to make your own food, which is nice, and the community is so supportive here. Water's for your dogs is so easy, and so there's a lot of creature comforts here.
Tocotna is also well positioned along the route. Fiedler opted to rest here in part because the trail has been going slow and he's hoping after a little more time it might become harder packed from cold and other teams traveling over it in the miles ahead. And for mushers planning to moves three or four steps ahead, like Cody Straith, the town is well positioned for the austere runs on the way to the Yukon River villages.
Right when you leave here, it's precisely 100 miles to Iditarod, so that's a good distance to split in half for your first start. You don't want to start with mega runs, so you do 250-mile runs. Conveniently, there's a shelter cabin 50 miles in, so you don't even have to sleep on the ground. So once you get to Iditarod, it's roughly another 50 miles to Shagaluk and so on. It kind of sets you up perfectly for getting out here if you were to stay.
Teams will start coming off their 24-hour rests in Tocotna this evening and take off overnight. Right behind them will be all the mushers who opted to stop earlier in McGrath, and ahead are the teams that gambled on pushing up to Ophir and Iditarod, which means in the days ahead, the race is really on.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The University of Alaska Anchorage is investing in Alaska by equipping students with the knowledge and tools for academic success. These students will go on to be the doctors, nurses, teachers, engineers, and artists of Alaska who shape the future of the state by bringing new solutions, inventions, and ideas to the table. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More information at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
The long-running lawsuit for Native people who were denied billions of dollars in trust fund money after decades of federal mismanagement is the subject of a new film. 100 Years, One Woman's Fight for Justice is the story of Blackfeet tribal member, the late Eloise Cobell. Cobell took on the Interior Department over missing funds in trust accounts that were supposed to be paid to Native landowners for oil and gas, grazing, and timber lease payments. Cobell's 15-year fight spanned three administrations and resulted in the largest federal government settlement in history during the Obama administration. Melinda Janko is the documentarian who produced the film. She said she'd never been to a reservation before she saw a small article on Cobell's fight.
I was so outraged by the injustice. I thought, how in the world can this be still going on today, that these people that own mineral-rich oil and gas land, where the oil wells are pumping 24/7, they're living in abject poverty without running water or electricity. How can that be? So I was just so totally outraged that I decided I needed to tell the world this story.
Was it eye-opening to understand what was going on with interior officials talking about warehouses where documents were being chewed on by rats and they were worried about the Hunta virus? Did you have any idea that this story was within our federal government about this situation going on between tribes and the feds when it came to these long-standing records?
No, I was quite naive about the federal government's gross mishandling, malfeasance, you think corruption, scandal, I mean, you name it.
Tell us about how you decided to approach telling this story, because it is an enormous tale. It involves tribes all across the country and goes back a century.
Well, I really wanted this film to be about contrast. I wanted to show the contrast between the powers that be and the people that live on the land, the people who have been victimized by the government. So that was a huge theme that runs throughout the film. And it was very, very difficult for me to take my crew out and film on Indian lands. We spent a lot of time in Navajo country. And I have to tell you, my film crew would look at me and they would scratch their head and they would say to me, "Are we really in America?" Because of the deplorable conditions that they were living in, with yet gas land, oil land, timber land, grazing land. It was unbelievable.
What's been the reception, both from Native and non-Native people, to seeing your film?
The reception from the non-Native people has been shock. They did not know about the story, which is exactly why I wanted to tell it. The response from the Native people has been wonderful. I have to say I've been pretty shocked at some of the response. From my very first screening that I had in L.A., I had people in the audience tell me, "Thank you so much for telling this story," because I got a Cobell check and I didn't know who Cobell was.
What do you hope people learn or take away when they see your film, both tribal people and non-Native people?
Well, I hope that they take away from this the power of one. What Eloise Cobell did was the impossible. She literally reformed the United States government. And when you have to have approval from all three executive levels of the government, unanimous approval across the board. That is amazing.
Melinda Janko produced and directed 100 Years, One Woman's Fight for Justice. The free showing will be tomorrow evening at East High School in Anchorage at 6:30 with a panel discussion to follow. In the past year, two ice seals have turned up in Unalaska, way outside their natural range. The first was spotted in late February of 2017, and less than a year later, another was photographed near town. Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel, has more on the unusual visitors.
Ringed seals do not belong in Unalaska.
Ringed seals are ice-associated seals, so they live and kind of work around the ice. They want to haul out on the ice for pupping and molting and resting.
Melissa Good works for Sea Grant. She's lived in Unalaska 7 years and has only seen two ringed seals, both in the last year. Good was able to send last year's seal to the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward, where the animal made a full recovery. But the most recent seal was not as healthy.
If you see a seal out of the water, laying on a rock, it looks kind of like a sausage. It's fat and it's round. When you start being able to see its hip bones and you see a hump on its back, that usually means that it doesn't have a lot of fat on it.
By the time Good was able to recover this seal, it was too late. The yearling had died. Results from a necropsy may shed some light on why there seem to be more ringed seals popping up in Unalaska. The pathologist will look for unusual bacteria, parasites, or viruses. Good thinks parasites might be the key.
A lot of the marine mammals that they're getting into the center do have heavier parasite loads than they have normally saw in the past, and they're contributing a lot of these parasite loads to warmer water conditions.
It's too soon to know exactly what's happening, but Good says it could be a combination of things. At this point, though, she isn't too concerned. Good's optimistic with more community interest and awareness of marine visitors, she'll be able to respond faster to stranded animals and better note changes in the environment. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Laura Kregel and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Casey Grove in Anchorage, and Zachariah Hughes in Tocotna. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m., only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.